April 15th is a special date for Americans, but it is no holiday. It is tax day. It is the last day to pay any federal taxes owed on earnings from the year before. The Constitution gives Congress the power to establish federal taxes. State and local governments can also tax, but the idea of national taxes took time to develop. Not everyone liked the idea. In 1791, Congress approved a tax on whiskey and other alcoholic drink. Farmers in western Pennsylvania who produced alcohol refused to pay. They attacked officials and burned the home of a tax collector. America's first president, George Washington, gathered almost 13,000 troops. The soldiers defeated the so-called Whiskey Rebellion of 1794. It was one of the first times that the government used its powers to enforce a federal law within a state. At first, the United States government collected most of its money through tariffs. These are taxes on trade. In the late 1800s, Congress began to tax people's pay. The Supreme Court rejected the personal income tax. But in 1913, the states passed the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. This gave Congress the right to tax income. Today, personal income tax provides the government with more than 40% of its money. Taxes collected to pay for retirement programs and other services provide 35%. Income taxes on businesses provided 7% of federal money in 2002, and the government collects other taxes, including customs. The Internal Revenue Service collects federal taxes. The IRS is part of the Treasury Department. Most taxpayers do not owe the agency any money on April 15th. Their employers have taken income taxes from their pay all year and already given it to the IRS. In fact, most people get some money back. But tax laws are often criticized as too complex. The United States has what is called a progressive tax system. Tax rates increase as earnings increase. This year, people who earn more than $312,000 are taxed at 35%. That is the highest rate. Individuals who earn less than $7,000 pay no income tax, but they do pay other taxes.
Markets are preparing for something that has not happened since May of 2000. The United States Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, is expected to raise interest rates at the end of this month. Interest is the cost to borrow money. As the cost increases, people generally borrow and spend less. Less spending means less demand, and that generally keeps prices from rising. So economists say interest rates are an important tool to fight inflation. Last week, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said the central bank will do what is required to keep prices under control. This is known as price stability. Later, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland said, "Current interest rates are too low." Sandra Pianalto said, "Inflation pressures appear reasonably under control right now." But she added that she is concerned that they could increase. Another Federal Reserve Bank president warned that recent price increases must be watched closely to see how much is temporary. Jack Gwynn in Atlanta said Federal Reserve policymakers need to react to whatever happens. The policymakers said in May that rate increases are likely to come at a measured speed. But Mr. Greenspan says they are prepared to act more quickly if needed. The Federal Reserve lends money to other banks at a rate set by the system's Open Market Committee. The federal funds rate is currently 1%, the lowest since 1958. This is not the rate for individual borrowers, however. Banks borrow from the Federal Reserve so they can then lend money to businesses, individuals, and each other. Low interest rates have led to record numbers of home sales in recent years. Now, interest rates for home loans are increasing. Economists say they are concerned that growth in jobs, high energy prices, and increased demand in the economy will push prices up. The government says prices rose at a yearly rate of 4.4% in the first 4 months of this year. For all of last year, the inflation rate was less than 2%. The Federal Open Market Committee will meet in Washington for 2 days, starting June 29th. The committee is expected to raise the federal funds rate from 1% to 1.25%.
Some form of gambling is legal in all 50 American states except two, Hawaii and Utah. Some states increasingly see games of chance as a good chance to help pay for services. A new law in Pennsylvania will permit as many as 61,000 slot machines in that state. Players put in money and hope to win more money. Pennsylvania expects to earn as much as $1,000 million a year. Governor Ed Rendell says some money will go to reduce property taxes. In Maryland, some lawmakers and Governor Robert Ehrlich want to make slot machines legal in their state as well. Maryland is next to Pennsylvania. Gambling on horse races is already legal in Maryland. Now, officials worry that Maryland will lose gambling money to Pennsylvania. Some people in Washington, D.C. want slot machines in the nation's capital. States with big budget deficits, like New York and California, also want to increase their gambling money. New York Governor George Pataki wants to put machines called video lottery terminals at horse races throughout the state. He says his plan would raise lots of money for education. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger recently signed deals with 5 Native American tribes. The tribes can now operate as many slot machines as they want. Gambling has become a major industry on tribal lands in the United States. Tribal governments do not pay taxes. But many states have agreements with tribes over gambling rights. Governor Schwarzenegger hopes California will receive $1,000 million for its current budget. But some people say public officials are taking too much of a chance on gambling. Religious leaders call it a social evil that ruins lives. Opponents say it brings crime and other problems. They argue that it does not create new wealth, but serves as a tax on the poor who are more likely to gamble. In 2000, the General Accounting Office of Congress released a report on the economic and social effects of gambling. The writers noted a finding that 86% of Americans reported having gambled at least once in their lives. But the report said that while it is easy to know how much money gambling raises, it is difficult to know how gambling affects society. Businesses are structured to meet different needs. One basic difference involves who is responsible for the business. Another involves how long the organization can stay in business. Today, we begin a report about ways that businesses are organized under United States tax law. The simplest form of business is called an individual proprietorship. The word proprietor comes from French and Latin words for property owner. The proprietor owns all the property of the business and is responsible for it. This means the proprietor receives all the profits. But this also means that the proprietor is responsible for all the debts of the business. Also, any legal action against an individual proprietorship is taken against the owner. The law recognizes no difference between the owner and the business. Most small businesses in the United States are individual proprietorships. The Census Bureau says there are more than 12 million of them. United States tax law has simpler reporting requirements for these kinds of businesses. One person may be able to complete all the tax documents required. Another kind of business is the partnership. Two or more people go into business together. An agreement is usually needed to state how much of the partnership each person controls. They can end the partnership at any time. But partnerships and individual proprietorships have a limited life. They exist only as long as the owners are alive. Some states permit what are called limited liability partnerships. These have full partners and limited partners. Limited partners may not share as much in the profits, but their responsibilities to the organization are also limited. A partnership is often called a pass-through entity. Money passes through it to the individual partners. The federal government does not tax partnerships, but the partners are taxed on the payments they received. Doctors, lawyers, and accountants often form partnerships to share the profits and risks of doing businesses. A husband and wife can form a business partnership. The Census Bureau says There are more than 1 million American partnerships. Bankruptcy is a process that, in some cases, can save a business. Companies that cannot pay their debts may go to bankruptcy court and seek protection from their creditors. In December of 2002, United Airlines declared bankruptcy. Since then, the carrier has continued to fly, and it has reorganized. The aim is to come out of bankruptcy and be able to meet financial responsibilities. United is the second largest airline company in the world. But last week, the government rejected a request for help. The parent company of United had asked the government to guarantee more than $1,000 million in loans. That meant the government would share responsibility if United could not repay the loans. A special committee decided against the aid. The Air Transportation Stabilization Board has three members. They represent the central bank, the Treasury, and the Transportation Department. Congress formed this board after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Air travel decreased after the attacks with hijacked planes. Congress approved loan guarantees of up to $10,000 million to help the transportation industry recover. But the board has used only about 15% of that, and the time limit to request aid has passed. In all, United made three requests for loan guarantees. The first was for $1.8 million in June of 2002. The board denied the request in December of that year. It rejected the business plan that United had proposed, but it gave United a second chance. Then, this past June, the board rejected a smaller request. It said, credit markets have improved, and guarantees were no longer necessary. Air travel has increased worldwide over the past year. Then, at the end of June, the board rejected a third and final request from United. United says it has cut about 37% of its jobs. It says it has cut costs by nearly $5,000 million. The airline is expected to ask for more pay cuts from its employees. And it is expected to seek at least $2,000 million in new financing without government guarantees. Last week, a group of three World Trade Organization officials ruled against the United States in a case brought by Brazil. They ruled that government payments to American cotton farmers violate international trade rules. Brazil seeks to stop the United States government from providing financial assistance to American cotton farmers. The assistance permits American farmers to plant more crops and produce extra cotton. This leads to lower prices for cotton on the world market. Brazil says the United States government unfairly hurts its foreign competition as a result. The United States is the world's largest exporter of cotton. The ruling by the WTO officials was not made public. The United States and Brazil are permitted time to seek changes to the ruling before a report is released. The WTO is expected to announce a final decision on the issue in June. United States Trade Representative Robert Zoellick says the government would appeal a WTO decision supporting the ruling. He says the United States will fight for its agricultural interests by negotiation or through legal action. The United States says its payments to farmers are permitted under WTO rules. Mr. Zoellick also criticized Brazil's method of dealing with the farm assistance issue. He suggested that Brazil could have saved time and protected relations by discussing its concerns in world trade talks. But Brazil's ambassador to the United States, Roberto Abdener, objected to the criticism. Ambassador Abdener said Brazil was forced to seek WTO judgment. He says the United States and other countries are unwilling to negotiate. The United States pays about 25,000 cotton farmers more than $2,000 million a year. It also makes payments to other farmers. Japanese and European governments also provide such support to farmers. And Brazil is not the only country angry about the issue. Several African representatives opposed farm assistance policies at a WTO ministers' meeting earlier this year. They argued that such policies hurt developing nations. Experts say other countries may seek similar action against American, European, or Japanese farm assistance if the WTO rules against the United States on the cotton issue. Discount stores sell goods at low prices. They succeed only if they sell a lot of goods and keep their costs low. One company has succeeded beyond imagination. Walmart is bigger than any competitor. It has more than 4,000 stores in the United States and 9 other countries. It has more than 1 million workers. It is America's largest private employer. Walmart reported sales of almost $260,000 million last year. And profits? The company reported earnings of $9,000 million last year. Sam Walton recognized the power of low prices. He owned 15 stores in Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma before he began Walmart. Sam Walton opened the first Walmart store in 1962. He began to use computers to control the flow of goods. He reduced prices to levels no one thought possible. By 1985, Sam Walton was the richest man in America. He added businesses like Sam's Club membership stores, and he opened more Walmart stores. Walmarts are big stores. They sell just about anything. Walmart supercenters are even bigger. They include a market full of food. Other food stores are worried. So are labor unions in that industry. To keep labor costs low, Walmart has worked hard to prevent its employees from joining a union. The company has faced legal actions over some of its employment activities. And last October, federal immigration agents raided 60 Walmart stores. They arrested more than 200 night cleaning workers who were in the country illegally. Walmart noted that an independent company employed them. But labor is not the only issue. Recently, the Los Angeles City Council began to consider a possible ban on huge stores like Walmart supercenters. Critics say Walmarts ruin small businesses and replace them with low-paying jobs. Walmart denies this happens. It says people save money, which they can spend on other things. Sam Walton died in 1992. He urged people to buy American products to save jobs and to control the trade deficit. Today, many goods are made in China. Walmart says it believes in buying American goods and is willing to pay more to offer them. But it says it cannot tell people what to buy.
This month, the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum opened its new Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Virginia, near Washington, D.C. Today, we tell about this new museum for famous aircraft.
The new Udvar-Hazy Center has been open for a little more than 3 weeks. However, it has already proven to be extremely popular. On December 26th, the road leading to the new museum was blocked with vehicles. Local television stations showed pictures of thousands of automobiles waiting their turn to enter the museum's parking area. Some vehicles were turned away. There was not enough room. The parking area was full. The new center may prove to be as popular as the main Air and Space Museum in Washington.
The National Air and Space Museum is perhaps the most visited museum in the world. Almost 10 million people visit the museum every year to see famous aircraft. They can see the Wright brothers' famous flyer. It was the first controllable aircraft to fly with an engine. It flew for the first time on December 17, 1903. Visitors to the National Air and Space Museum can also see Charles Lindbergh's airplane, the Spirit of St. Louis. He became the first pilot to fly across the Atlantic Ocean alone and without stopping from the United States to France. That flight took place in May of 1927. Near the famous plane is an orange rocket plane that became the first aircraft to fly faster than the speed of sound. Pilot Chuck Yeager made that flight in 1947. Visitors to the museum can even touch a small piece of the moon. It was brought back to Earth by American astronauts who walked on the moon.
The main job of a museum is to keep and protect important objects from the past so they can be studied, examined, and enjoyed in the future. Displaying these collected objects helps the public understand the importance of a museum's work. Finding room to keep a collection of aircraft has always been a problem for the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. This museum only holds about 10% of the aircraft it has collected over the years. Another 10% of the aircraft have been loaned to other museums. The other 80% have been kept in storage buildings for safekeeping. Some of them have been stored for as long as 50 years. The opening of the museum's new Udvar-Hazy Center has changed this. As many as 300 aircraft will be placed on display in the new museum. More than 80 of them have already been placed in the building for the public to see.
The new center was named for Stephen Udvar-Hazy. He came to the United States from Hungary. He became very successful in the aircraft industry. He became so successful that he gave the National Air and Space Museum $65 million to help build the new center. Mr. Udvar-Hazy said he wanted to give something to America for the opportunities he found here. He also wanted to pass on his love of aviation to the people of the future.
Mr. Udvar-Hazy's gift helped build the center. It did not pay the total cost. That is expected to be more than $300 million. This includes the design, construction, and cost of moving the aircraft into the new center. The largest of the new center's several buildings is huge. It is 31 meters high, almost 76 meters wide, and 300 meters long. Visitors can see and walk near the aircraft on three levels in the main building. They can walk near the largest aircraft on the museum's floor. Smaller aircraft are hung from the ceiling. Visitors can examine them from several walkways that are about 15 meters above the floor. They can see other aircraft that are hung near the ceiling. They can do this from walkways that are near the top of the building. Computers at small information centers show close-up photographs of the aircraft. These photographs include pictures taken inside the aircraft. Visitors can use the computers to see the pilot's controls, passenger areas, and other parts of the inside of the aircraft. In the future, these pictures will be on the new museum's computer link with the Internet.
All of the aircraft that will be on display are important to the history of flight. Some are huge. The largest aircraft in the collection was given to the museum only a few months ago. It is the Air France Concorde. The plane landed at nearby Dulles International Airport on its last flight. It was pulled by a special vehicle to the museum. The Concorde was one of the few passenger airplanes that could fly faster than the speed of sound. A Concorde flight from Paris, France to Washington, D.C. usually took less than 4 hours. The new center also has very small aircraft in the collection. One is the Boeing P-26A pea shooter. The little pea shooter could hide under the wing of the Concorde. In fact, several of them could hide there. The pea shooter was a military fighter plane. It was built in the early 1930s. It is also one of the most beautiful aircraft in the new center. Most military aircraft are not painted with bright colors, but the pea shooter has wings painted yellow gold. The body is painted black with white stripes down its side. The front is painted a shiny white.
The new Udvar-Hazy Center also holds the fastest aircraft ever built. It is the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird. It looks like a rocket plane, but it is not. It has an aircraft jet engine, not a rocket engine. The military used the Blackbird to gather intelligence. It carried cameras, not guns. It used its great speed to fly away from danger. The Blackbird is a large aircraft. It is painted with a dull black paint and looks like a bullet. In fact, it is faster than many bullets. It could travel at 3 times the speed of sound. That is about 3,540 kilometers an hour. The last time a Blackbird flew was from Los Angeles, California, to Dulles International Airport near the museum. The United States Air Force flew it for the last time to deliver it to the Udvar-Hazy Center. That flight from California to Virginia took only 1 hour, 4 minutes, and 20 seconds.
Many of the aircraft in the collection were built for military use. However, the museum is not just a collection of military aircraft. Aviation experts say new flight technology has often been used first in the design of military aircraft. For example, the first jet was a military airplane. Civilian aircraft designers quickly used jet technology because jets are faster and cheaper. An aircraft called the Dash 80 is a good example of military technology being used for civilian purposes. The Boeing company built the aircraft. Its real name is the Boeing 367-80. It was designed as the first modern jet passenger aircraft. It first flew in July of 1954. It does not look much different from aircraft used today by airlines around the world. Later, a similar aircraft was given the numbers 707. The 707 was the first extremely successful passenger jet aircraft. It served as the first jet aircraft for many of the world's passenger airlines. The Dash 80 looks very new, not 50 years old.
National Air and Space Museum officials say they expect about 3 million visitors a year to the new center. Many of these visitors will be school children. The center includes school rooms and will provide teachers with teaching materials. One of the center's goals will be to educate the children of the future about the importance of aviation. Smithsonian officials recognize that it is difficult for many people to visit either of these two flight museums. In the near future, They hope to display photographs and information about all the aircraft on the Internet.
Today, we tell about the lighthouses that protect ships sailing along the coast of North Carolina.
Lighthouses are built along coasts to signal to passing ships. Lighthouses are tall buildings of wood or stone or brick with large bright lights on top. Every night, they shine lights to warn ships about dangerous areas where there are rocks, low water levels, or strong currents. The lighthouses along North Carolina's coast are recognized as signs of safety for travelers at sea. Over the years, fierce ocean storms have sent many ships crashing into the North Carolina coast. Other boats have been lost in wars. During World War II, for example, German submarines sank many Allied transport ships in that area. History experts say more than 600 ships have been wrecked near the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Storms still uncover the ruins of wrecked ships along the Outer Banks. The lighthouses shine their signals to prevent more wrecks. Many ships and lives have been saved because of the United States Lifesaving Service and workers at lighthouses along the coast.
The Outer Banks is a group of narrow islands stretching along the North Carolina coast in the Atlantic Ocean. The islands shelter North Carolina's inland water passages. For thousands of years, these barrier islands have survived severe weather. Every few years, an ocean storm in the North Atlantic Ocean will move through the Outer Banks with destructive force. Each island of the Outer Banks has its own lighthouse with a special design and history. In addition, each lighthouse has its own signal, which boats see from a distance. The different light signals help sailors identify their position from the land. This helps them judge if they are close to dangerous water passages. Today, the light signals work on an electrical timing system. In the past, workers living in the lighthouses had to turn the lights on and off.
North Carolina's simplest lighthouse is on Ocracoke Island in the southern Outer Banks. Ocracoke Lighthouse was built in 1823. It is considered the oldest lighthouse on the Carolina coast. Its signal is a continuous white light, which can be seen almost 25 kilometers out at sea. Although the plans used to build Ocracoke Lighthouse appear normal, the building was built off-center. As a result, it rises more sharply on one side. Ocracoke Island is said to be the place where the pirate Blackbeard lost his head in the early 1700s. This famous ocean robber was killed in a battle with a British officer more than a century before Ocracoke Lighthouse was built. Lieutenant Robert Maynard was protecting England's colonial interest in the New World. Historians say he tricked Blackbeard into battle and then cut off his head. stories passed down through the years say that the spirit of Blackbeard still walks around Ocracoke Island searching for his head.
Many people agree that the most recognized lighthouse in America is at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. The building stretches 58 meters in the air, making it the tallest brick lighthouse in the country. It was completed in 1870. Its signal shines a white light every 7.5 seconds. Ships 37 kilometers from land are able to see the signal. Historians believe more people have read about, painted, or taken pictures of the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse than any other lighthouse in North America. It is the picture on the official documents of the United States Lighthouse Service. It is also a memorial to hundreds of men and women who worked to make North Carolina's coast safe for sea travelers.
In 1999, the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse was moved more than 900 meters. Officials wanted to protect the building by moving it farther away from the ocean. Huge lift equipment picked up the more than 4,000-ton building and carried it inland. The lighthouse was then lowered onto a new 18-meter square concrete support structure. Engineers inspected the repositioned building. They declared that it is standing tall and strong on its new foundation. Visitors can climb to the top of the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse, but they need to be in good physical condition. This is because 268 steps lead to the top of North America's tallest brick lighthouse.
Another lighthouse along North Carolina's Outer Banks is the Body Lighthouse. Its history is quite interesting. The fifth financial inspector of the United States Treasury Department built the first Body Lighthouse in 1848. Stephen Pleasanton's main concern while building the structure was to save money. As a result, his workers were not permitted to spend enough money to build a safe base. In addition, the building was fitted with a light system that was not considered effective even then. Shortly after it opened, Body Island Lighthouse started sinking on one side. Workers soon had to leave it. Several years later, the United States Congress ordered a new lighthouse be built. In 1852, work began on a new and improved structure. The second Body Lighthouse was to be representative of a new look in lighthouses. It was shaped like a circular cone made of earthen bricks made hard in a fire. Its base was built on supporting bars driven into the earth.
The second Body Lighthouse was destroyed in the American Civil War. Confederate soldiers from the South wrecked the building to prevent the Union Navy of the North from gaining a position to help its ships. The structure was finally rebuilt and completed in 1872. It rises 48 meters in the air. Today, the Body Lighthouse needs several repairs. This is why the building is not open to the public to climb. However, the lighthouse signal is still recognized by passing ships. It is on, off, and on again for 2.5 seconds each time, then off for 22.5 seconds. Boats up to 33 kilometers out at sea are able to recognize the body lighthouse signal.
The most northern lighthouse on North Carolina's Outer Banks is at Currituck Beach. Like the other lighthouses along the coast, the Currituck Beach Lighthouse still serves as an aid to sailors. The lighthouse runs its light signal from sunset to sunrise. The signal is 3 seconds on, 17 seconds off. The light can be seen as far away as 33 kilometers. The Currituck Beach Lighthouse remains unpainted to help tell it apart from other lighthouses along the coast. This also gives visitors a strong sense of the 1.5 million bricks used to build the building, which stands 47 meters in the air. The Currituck Beach Lighthouse was completed in 1875. It was the last major brick lighthouse built on the Outer Banks. Visitors are permitted to climb to the top.
Wild horses run free near the Currituck Beach Lighthouse. Horses are not native to North America. Yet for more than 400 years, these animals have run unrestricted along the northern Outer Banks. Historians are not sure how the horses first arrived in America. They believe either Spanish or English settlers transported them. The wild horses are called barbs. They are known for their size, their ability to work hard, their easy movement, and their long lives. Historians say there was nothing but sea, sand, and grass when these barb horses first arrived on the Outer Banks. A continual increase in summer visitors over the past 40 years has made survival for the horses more difficult. Because of this, a group of concerned citizens has built a fence to separate the horses from people. This gives them about 6,000 hectares of land to live on. The group is trying to make sure the animals will be permitted to stay on Currituck Beach. Like the lighthouses, the wild barb horses are a traditional part of life on the Outer Banks of North Carolina.
English. Today we present the first of two programs about some of the most famous people who lived in the American West many years ago. We tell about lawmen, criminals, and gunfighters. And we will try to tell as much truth as possible about this interesting time in American history.
Our story begins in 1883 in Dodge City, Kansas. Dodge City was a railroad town. Huge herds of cattle were brought there from western states to be transported by railroad to markets in the eastern United States. A man named Luke Short owned a small store where he sold alcohol. People also took part in gambling, games of chance, in his store. Several people who owned similar businesses wanted Luke Short to leave Dodge City. They did not like the business competition. Luke Short was threatened several times. He knew his life was in danger, so he left Dodge City.
Several weeks later, the people in Dodge City began to see something that frightened them. Strangers were entering the town. All of these men carried guns. The men said they were friends of Luke Short. They caused no trouble. A newspaper in Dodge City printed a story that identified the men. One of the first of these men to arrive was a former Dodge City lawman. His name was William Masterson. The newspaper said he was well known as an expert with guns and had killed several men. His friends called him Bat. Two other men arrived together. One was Wyatt Earp. He was a famous gunfighter from Tombstone in the Arizona Territory. He also was a former lawman who had killed men in gunfights. With him was his friend, a dentist, John Holliday, who also survived several shooting incidents. His friends called him Doc. About 12 other men also arrived in Dodge City to help Luke Short. They were not as famous as the three named in the newspaper, but they were also considered to be very dangerous.
Luke Short returned to Dodge City wearing his guns. The chief lawman of the town quickly sent a telegram to the governor of the state asking for help. He was afraid a major civil war would begin in his town. The men who had forced Luke Short out of town decided to negotiate a settlement. They did not want to face his many dangerous friends. A few days after the settlement, Bat Masterson, Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and the other dangerous friends of Luke Short left Dodge City. No one ever fired a shot. No one was even threatened. All it took to force a negotiated settlement was for these dangerous men to show their faces in Dodge City. Just the fear of them settled the argument in favor of Luke Short. No one wanted to deal with men who were not afraid of a gunfight.
Who were these dangerous men? Why did people fear them so much? Why did they become so famous? The story of these famous men began a little before the American Civil War of the 1860s. This wild and lawless period in the West has been shown in hundreds of movies, television programs, and books. It only lasted for about 70 years. The first shooting incident by a person who could be considered a professional gunman took place in Texas in 1854. Most of the shooting incidents between professional lawmen and outlaws took place during the 1870s in Texas.
The real movement into the American West began after the Civil War. Many families moved west to build new lives after the war. Land was almost free. Some people wanted to find gold or silver and become rich. Other families wanted to raise cows or horses, or begin a farm and start a new life. But living in the American West was not easy. There were no laws, no courts, and little or no government. There were few lawmen to keep order. The people who arrived in the West included many criminals. Many were escaping punishment for their crimes. They knew that an area with no law would provide them with safety. These professional criminals often used force to take what they wanted, cows, horses, or money. Often, there was little to stop them.
Honest people who moved to the West carried weapons to protect themselves and their property. These settlers began to build small towns when they found areas they liked. They tried to improve their towns with churches, schools, and the rule of law. But it was often difficult. To protect their towns, the settlers often had to employ people who were expert in the use of firearms. Several lawmen in the Old West had learned to use their weapons when they were criminals. Both the outlaws and the lawmen in the Old West had something else in common. They could do something many other people could not. They were willing to risk their lives to enforce the law or to commit a crime, and they were willing to do this with a gun.
A good example was a man named William Matthew Tillman. He was arrested 2 times and charged with stealing when he was a young man. However, he later became a deputy United States Marshal, a law officer. On July 4, 1888, a man named Ed Prather began shooting his gun in the street in Farmer City, Kansas. People ran away in fear. Tillman made him stop. Prather left the street angry and went into a drinking place. He began drinking alcohol and making threats. Later, Tillman went into the drinking place looking for Prather. Prather put his hand on the gun he was carrying. Tillman told him to move his hand away from the gun. When he did not obey, Bill Tillman pulled out his gun and shot Ed Prather 2 times. He died immediately.
That was only one of the many times Bill Tillman used a gun as a law officer. He served in many other towns. Often, all he had to do was walk into a room to stop a fight. Outlaws feared and obeyed him. Most criminals stayed away from a town where Bill Tillman was the marshal. Bill Tillman was shot to death on November 1, 1924. He was trying to arrest a man who had been drinking too much alcohol. He was 70 years old and still working as the marshal of Cromwell, Oklahoma. His life had lasted exactly the 70 years of the American Wild West.
The famous American gunman named Wyatt Earp has been the subject of at least 4 major motion pictures, 1 television series, and many books. He served as a marshal in Tombstone, Arizona. He took part in one of the most famous gunfights in American history, the gunfight at the OK Corral. Wyatt Earp was once asked how to win a gunfight. He said a good gunfighter took his time. He said he had to go into action as quickly as possible, as fast as he could move. But then he should take his time with the shooting. He said a successful gunfighter could not let fear or anything else force him to shoot too soon and miss the target. Missing the target could get him killed. Wyatt Earp was very successful. He was only wounded once in a gunfight. He is one of the few successful gunfighters who lived to old age. He died in 1929. He was 81 years old.
Experts on the American West often disagree about who were the most dangerous gunmen in that period of American history. Was it one of the famous lawmen? Was it Bill Tillman? Or perhaps Wyatt Earp? Or was it one of the outlaws? Maybe it was the famous bank robber Jesse James, or an extremely dangerous gunman named John Wesley Hardin. Those questions will never truly be answered. However, join us next week when we